So thank you for inviting me to speak tonight and share everything I don't know about the Dharma. And the question's an interesting one because it's the same question that the Buddha tried to answer, or did answer. He framed it a little bit different, and his question was, how do we end suffering? How do we end suffering? You know, where is the end of suffering, or can suffering be ended? It's a really big question, isn't it? It's like a tricky one, because I don't know about you, but I find life is a challenge. Full stop. And what would you say if I said, well, you actually can't overcome the challenges? They're endless. As long as you've got a body, you'll suffer. I can tell you that from experience. And as you get older, you suffer more, especially through the body. And in fact, as you live longer, you suffer more because you experience more loss and grief and tragedy and things going wrong. Sounds great, doesn't it? Have you found that true in your own short existences so far? Is your suffering getting less or more as you get older? Great when we're kids, isn't it? If you're lucky, because it's not great for all kids. I particularly work in an area that has a lot of child protection, so constantly I read and listen to and talk about and see children that, you know, experience great pain and suffering and trauma. So they don't even have a good start. When I worked in children's oncology, if you're not medically aware, oncology being the children's cancer ward, you know, one of the last infants I looked after was born with a tumour, was born with cancer. So one of the problems actually that we have is that we think that we can overcome challenges and that we can stop them occurring, but that's not true. The Buddha suffered. Did you know that? The Buddha suffered till he died. I mean, if you're 80 years old, you're walking up and down in the north of India, rain, hail and shine, winter and summer. It's not comfortable. And in fact, there's a passage in the suttas where the Buddha says, you know, the only time I don't suffer is when I'm in deep meditation. That's a benefit of meditation, but again, the reason why the Buddha kept developing his Dharma was that before he became enlightened and he went to the other two schools of the two teachers before that, he realised that even though he could attain great kind of bliss and peace and stillness in meditation, when the meditation ended, everything went back to the way it was, i.e. everything started to have this flavour of being not very enjoyable, irritable, you know, not really pleasant. If you're lucky, it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So what do we do in the Western world and in all over the world to cope with the challenges of life? The Western world in particular, because we have the benefit of more affluence. We're not as tied to the immediacy of trying to have food and shelter or safety, because there are plenty of places in the world, and even in the Western world, there are plenty of places where daily life is painful and suffering. And not safe. But for a large part of us, you know, and particularly, you know, like I saw, I don't know how true it is, but it sounded pretty true, because when you start to look at the worldwide figures on poverty, you know, you realise that out of the 7 billion people in the world, probably over 6 billion of them have a pretty hard time. So I think it went something like, if you woke up this morning, 1, in a bed, 2, in a house, and you had water and food, and maybe money, you were probably in the top 10% of the world's population. So that makes you a winner, doesn't it? Because a large part of modern life in the Western world is like, one of the biggest challenges, particularly when you're younger, I think you have a lot more than people of my generation now, is this idea that you have to win somehow. You have to be successful. I don't know, might have just been the environment that I grew up in, but no one can. We didn't talk about being successful. We didn't talk about needing to get, you know, $100,000 a year job and get a car and do this and have a gap year and go see Europe and stuff like that. We just went, oh, you're going to finish school? Oh, maybe. Go to uni? No, I don't think so. You know? Oh, there's a job going down the road. I might go there, see if I can do that. And you literally could. One of my brothers, you know, he didn't get along with everyone very well, so he went through a lot of jobs. But he could literally walk out of one factory and into another on the same day. He could start with a different company on the same day. You can't do that anymore. I get applications now in my position. No, I get 50 or 60 people apply. Some of them have been doctors in their own countries, and they're applying for work as, you know, cleaners in a ward. It's a rosy picture, isn't it? But this is what the Buddha was saying. The Buddha was saying that life is suffering. Life is a challenge, full stop. Birth is a challenge. Before birth, finding a partner is a challenge, isn't it? Finding someone you can tolerate, that you like to be with, or might like you. Surviving your parents is the next challenge. Or your brothers and your sisters. Even if you're in a reasonably nice world. Do you know? If you're at uni, you're surviving your lecturers, the crowds, getting on a bus. So there's all this constant kind of interference going on. You're never going to get it the way you want it. This is what suffering is. So suffering isn't necessarily just this idea. You have to let go of the idea that suffering is just this kind of awful trauma. You know, you get kidnapped and chained and tortured and branded, and cut up and sort of kicked. That happens to some people, but for all of us, suffering is just, why is the bus late? I ordered coffee, why is it cold? You know, why don't they have my favourite pizza? What's this? Why do I have to sit next to the smelliest person in the room? Why can't this lecturer make sense of it? Do you know? It's all those little things that go through your mind every day about, you know, someone should tell that person they shouldn't wear those clothes. It doesn't suit them. That sort of stuff. It's the suffering is actually your mind is your suffering. That's your challenge. Life is what it is. And wherever you go, it's going to be kind of more agreeable or less agreeable. It really is. You know? Where the challenge really is in your own mind. The real challenge is, how do you find peace? How do you find wisdom? How do you have compassion? Because these are the qualities of the Buddha. And I'm making this assumption because it is a Dharma talk, so I assume you're Buddhists and you know a little bit about the Buddha. And, you know, our Buddha, the one that we've been taught about, was the Buddha of compassion and wisdom. So how do you have compassion and wisdom for people that, you know, really, you just wish they would disappear someday? May you be well, happy and peaceful, and may you just piss off. You know? Go forth. We used to use the term, go forth and reproduce. It just means fuck off. So, this is the real challenge, because what happens is life kind of provokes what's already a kind of angry bear. Some people have more or less, some people have more or less, some people are more inclined to kindness and compassion and trying to understand things than others. You know, that's why there are some people in the room, but there's not 1,000. And in fact, when you do studies of religion and spirituality, regardless of whether it's Buddhism or Christianity, the rates are going down. You know, when I came to Sydney in the late 80s, you know, you were, the school system, there was all these Catholic schools, and there was actually still Catholic kind of priests preaching them. You go to a Catholic school these days, you'll be lucky to see a priest or a monk teaching in those schools. I actually stayed in a seminary for about 4 months. It's full of priests and brothers. They're empty now. No one's joining up. The attendant, yeah?
Can I just ask why you think you'd be lucky to see a priest?
Oh, because there's no one's joining.
Isn't that good? I mean.
Oh, well, based on the other things in the paper, it makes.
The Catholic Church are pretty.
Yeah.
You know, they call some untold suffering.
Well, you could say that's karma coming. That's why. But I guess the reason why I would, you know, people, because all of the information and all of the things that happened that were repressed are now becoming knowledge. So if you look at a film like Spotlight, you know, it uncovers all of that. Spotlight's, it's just come out. I don't know if it's on DVD, but, and the model of what they did there, and like, I don't want to divert into the sexual practices of Catholic priests, but.
But it's not only that, it's just a spread of AIDS in Africa.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, look, and there's all those arguments about whether it was introduced by vaccines and things like
that. I don't mean that. I mean the Catholic Church preventing the
music. Oh, yeah, they're bad practices. But you could say what's happening with the Church is karmic in the sense that now that the things that have taken place under their banner have become more known. But don't forget, you had 400 years of them killing and torturing people around the world, and that made them more popular. You know that, so maybe there's a consciousness raising going on. I actually don't think so, because it's Mara's world. So when you look at what Mara's world is about, Mara wants you to stay in samsara. So what's samsara? Samsara is the endless wandering in the material world. And that's where, even though I'm not Tibetan, I really like that depiction, the Tibetan wheel of life, whereby it's kind of like a heavenly zone, all the heavenly realms up here, all the hell realms down here, and everything in between. And the idea that we are constantly moving up and down in these realms. Sometimes you're in the heavenly realms, and sometimes you're in the hell realms. So don't forget Devadatta, the Buddha predicted with Devadatta, who was his cousin, that you know, he'd go to hell after that, and he would actually become Mara for a while, and then he would be eventually reborn as a Paticca Buddha. You know, so it's just that notion that nothing's permanent. Even suffering is not permanent. But the danger is not so much that in this life you go to heaven or hell. But what the Buddha was pointing out was that it doesn't matter, because even if you go to heaven, eventually you're going to come back out of it. So if you take the long view, it's not about just getting yourself to heaven in this life, because that will give you respite. That'll give you a few good years or a few good thousand years or even a million years, but it comes to an end. And when you look at what's in the moment, when you experience that mindfulness of the present moment, a present moment is infinity. You know, that's what it is. And so we get caught up in this life of taking the life that we have as so serious, of owning this body and this idea of who we are. So I really like that Zen teaching which says, what was the face you had before you were born? What is your true self? Is what it's asking. And see, the trouble with the world, the challenge of the world is you get born, and you get born with parents that say, you've got to be like this. You've got to do law, you've got to do medicine, you've got to do that. Or you get parents that say, I don't care what you do, just get out of my way. You know? And stop costing me so much money. Be nice to your sister. Don't pull faces at your grandma, you know. But it's that kind of conditioning that we get from our parents to tell you who you have to be, when you don't even know who you are yet. So it makes it very easy then to listen to your parents telling you, oh, I may as well do what they do, because I don't know what I'm going to do. Oh, I'll just go along with them for a while until I work it out. Before you know it, that's who you are. And then you think, oh, I can't not do this, because if I don't do that, Mum's going to be really upset, or Dad's going to be really upset. So we get conditioned to think. The thing that goes along with all these decisions that we make is that we have this thing called neural pathways. We have a brain, you know? And the neural pathways get conditioned. What that actually means is there's a process in neural biology whereby those neural pathways eventually get covered. They get if you've got a biological background, you know they get myelinated. What that means is they get encased, so that makes them stronger, so they exist. So this is why it's so difficult to say, I'm going to change tomorrow. You know, from tomorrow I'm going to be really nice to everyone, I'm not going to have bad thoughts about anyone, I'm just going to be nice, I'm going to be polite, I'm going to be kind. You know, I'm no longer going to be mean and do anything bad. and you wake up in the morning and, you know, 10 minutes into your day, you've already had 100 bad thoughts about, you know, or negative thoughts about someone or other. Well, I've got to go and do that today, I don't like it. Because the choices we make lead to neural pathways. They reinforce kind of path. So I grew up in the country, and one of the things is a dairy farm next to me. So every day, twice a day, the cows would come in to get milked. And I knew exactly where they were going to be and at what time because of their conditioning. The interesting thing about their conditioning in the way that they would always turn up at the same time is that by following the same path, there was this kind of meter-wide dirt track that went through the grass hills because that's the path they followed. And because they followed it every day, they wear out the grass and they leave a path. So when you have a thought and you keep sending the same thought, it builds a pathway. What the Buddha said, it puts a groove in the mind. So he's way ahead of his time, I love it. How someone 2,500 years ago could understand that if you do something repeatedly, it puts a groove in the mind, and what we now understand today is neural pathways. And it's pretty fantastic considering he did it without a lab or, you know, experiments or research or microscopes. Just to understand that if you repeat things over and over again, whether it's a behaviour or a thought, you create a neural pathway for that. And that's why change is so hard. I think at the moment in the city they're trying to change George Street into like a pedestrian, right? And they predict it's going to take them 3 or 4 years to do that because they've got to stop traffic going down it, they've got to open up other roads and things like that. And it's kind of no different when you start trying to change your thoughts. Say if you're an angry person all the time and you want to be less angry. Well, your angry thoughts don't just stop because you've decided to be less angry. Your angry thoughts actually will continue as they've always continued. They're not going anywhere. You actually have to make a conscious decision to just, the first thing you do is just to notice them and try not to give life to them. So you have an angry thought about, you know, your lecturer or your neighbour, and you try not to yell at them. If I'm in my car and someone cuts me off, I try not to swear, you know. But my first thought is, you know. So you've got to stop that thought. Well, not just, you can't stop it, but you've got to stop the reaction to it. After that, you've got to try and open up a new pathway that might go, you know, if you want to be Buddhist about it, may you be well, happy and peaceful. Yeah. So you've got to try and stop one thing and encourage another thing. And that's a physical process because you have to repeatedly go, I want everyone to be happy. Even the people I don't like, I want them to be happy. You know, I want to be happy and I want them to be happy too and safe. It's never going to happen. So you don't do it because you're going to get the result that you're looking for. You know, just because you decide to take on board a practice and trying to encourage yourself to be open-hearted and kind and in the hope that that helps you to become a calmer person and a wiser person, and in that process of becoming calmer and wiser to develop the insight into wisdom that allows you to see through anicca, anatta and dukkha. Because once you see through anicca, anatta and dukkha, you know, non-self, suffering and impermanence, then you've got the same understanding of the Buddha. And that's what cuts that attachment to who you think you are and what you think you have to do. That's your real challenge. Overcoming the idea that you think you have to be this way, or things have to be this way, or this is who I am, and this is who I'll always be. Because if you really think that, you know, there is a true self inside you, there is this identifiable self that you can find and improve and make even better, then you're deluded. Because you'll never find it. You know, if you lose, you think about if this is you and this is your body and this is who you are. You know, as a thought experiment, you lose your left leg, are you still you? If you lose your right leg, are you still you? If you lose your left arm, are you still you? If you lose your right arm, are you still you? When do you stop being you? you just become you with a lot of challenges to learn how to live without arms and legs, but you're still you because the I is the sense of I of who you think you are. But who did you think you were at five? Do you remember? Were you Batman? If you like one of my nephews? Batman one day, Spider-Man the next. Superman. Who were you at eight? What was the difference between you at eight and five? Who were you at 10? Are they any less you? When you were a baby and in nappies and you weed yourself and you pooed yourself and your parents had to change you, was that you? Who are you at 15? Is that you? Is that your real you? So you see, your I is not located in a time or a place, is it? It's just an idea, it's a thought. But when you were five, you knew who you were, because you would have said something like, I'm Timmy. What's the problem? That's who I am. It's actually quite simple, because you're not complicated by that. And you can see, as you've gotten older, your idea of who you are has gotten more complicated, hasn't it? And it's not really because you've gotten more complicated. It's probably because you've taken on more ideas about who you think you have to be and what makes a good self, what makes a good me. If you listen to a band like Radiohead, they've got a lovely song, I want a perfect body, I want a perfect soul. We want to be perfect, but there's no perfect. We want to please other people, but you can't please them because they keep asking for more. You want to get good at marks in this exam this year, what about next year's? See how it just goes on. You finish uni, you get a job. Have I got a good job? Is it paying enough? When will I get promoted? When am I going to get that holiday? When am I going to get that perfect partner? When am I going to have a perfect child? Every one of those things that you get brings a whole lot of suffering. Doesn't it, girls? Boyfriends never do what you want. Boyfriends, girlfriends never do what you want. And they always ask for more. They're never satisfied. Do you know? Parents, they always want more. And they always remind you how much they've done for you. And how could you be so selfish? You know? Which is what their parents probably said to them. But and people don't communicate then about what they really mean. You know, they don't say, well, I really care about you and I want the best for you. And I think if you do this, that'll be good for you, is a better message rather than you have to do this, you have to do that. So how do you be true then when you try to make other people happy all the time? How can you do that? Have you had any luck? If you make someone else happy, does it work? Does it last? Okay, you did that. Right, now you need to do this. God, I can get you down, can't it? But it never stops. You get older as you get older. So like if you do get married to the perfect person and you have children, the child can get sick. Then you've got all that worry about what happens if something happens to my baby. That's what your parents worry about with you. What happens to my son or daughter? How can I protect them? I know, I can protect them by making sure they do what I want them to do. The way I want them to do it. Then they'll be okay. But you're not. You're never okay. None of us know how close we've been to death, their missus. Who knows, you know? We think we're safe all the time, but you only have to read one paper in a day and it's full of people who've died without realising they were going to die that day. It's full of tragedy of things that happened unexpectedly. It's not until it happens to you that you suddenly realise the world's not safe. There's a lot to be anxious about all the time. Just recently in my life I've had friends lose their job, lose partners, you know, been separated from their children, had people die unexpectedly young, you know, 30 years of age. There's about half a dozen people in my life that have had, it's just in the last month, experienced great tragedy. They're all nice people, you know, they do good things and they look after others. And I think if you talk to your parents and your friends, you start to see there's a lot of, this is what working in aged care and children's and paediatric units taught me, is that it's all unpredictable, really unpredictable. We make plans, it's okay to make a plan. It's okay to have a good idea about where you want to go and what you want to do. If you think it's, you know, particularly like in my 20s, I had no idea really. So I ended up doing nursing and I didn't like it, but I didn't have anything better to do, so I kept with it. Working part-time, you know, but it wasn't pushing my buttons. You know, it gave me a bit of money to travel, that sort of stuff. But in hindsight, in my late 30s, it led to the career and the job that I've got now. I could never have predicted that, because if I could have gotten out of it and got a better job, or what I thought was a better job in my 20s or 30s, I would have done that. You know? But what was important to me and my values kind of changed over time. And yours will as well, because they already have, and they'll continue to do that. We play by the rules, but the rules, when people break the rules with us, people then stop worrying about the rules. Why should I follow the rules? No one follows them for me. Why should I care about, you know, why should I do what you want? You never do what I ask. You know? Parents are tricky because they've got the advantage of saying, you know, they brought you into this world and they've spent all this money on you, you know, so you owe, so give back. That's not giving, that's conditional. Real giving is there, it's yours, have it, here's your life. So in Buddhism, one of the stories that he told was about the prodigal son. I know you might remember that Jesus also talked about the prodigal son, but the Buddhist version is slightly different. In the Christian version, when the prodigal son turns up, having wasted his inheritance and forgotten who he is, when he returns home, the father rushes out and says, "Welcome back. Come on board, you know, get a seat at the table." In the Buddhist version, the prodigal son takes off, wastes his inheritance, trashes himself, doesn't even recognise his own family and father or home when he goes back. It's a big ask, really, but it is a story. So he wanders back to his old farm and, you know, begging for food. And the guy, he recognises his son, the farmer recognises his son, says, "No, come on in. I'll give you something to eat and somewhere to stay and I'll give you work." So he put him to work in the stables, cleaning the shit. And after he got better at that, he gave him a job. Now you can feed the animals instead. And when he got good at that, he said, "Okay, now you can give a hand doing this and that." Until he knew everything about the farm, and then he reminded him about who he was. There's a very powerful message in that, because we're all prodigal children. We're all born with an inheritance that we waste, that we don't even know we've got. So what were the words of the Buddha after his enlightenment? He opened his eyes in the morning. Do you remember what he said? Do you know that part of the story? You're a terrible Buddhist. You're the worst Buddhist I've ever met. Don't take that personally, because there's no self. So he said, when he opened his eyes, he said, "How wonderful, how marvellous, all beings have this purity. All beings have this." That's, you know, all of us. We have this purity inside you. You know, and it's awe-inspiring. But we lose it. We don't even look for it, because we think we have to get this, that and the other. We have to do this, that and the other. So how to find that inheritance again? And again, the metaphor in the story is that we do have to clean the shit away. What's the shit in our lives? And in terms of Buddhism, it's the kalesas. It's greed, hatred, desire, sloth and torpor, doubt, anxiety, restlessness. Those five kind of hindrances. So I'm not saying you have to go home and tell your parents where to go, because, you know, I'm going to overcome life's challenges now. That there is something honourable about, you know, trying in that sense to be respectful and to honour what's been done for you. But at the same time, it is a two-way thing, because you know, what that does when you feel that burden of care all the time, you may fulfil that, but it comes at a cost. Do you want to turn into your parents when you have your children? Do you want to find yourself saying the same things to them, making them feel the same way that you've been made to feel? Because that's the only way you know. And I can tell you, because I work in this field, that all the research tells us that people tend to parent the way they were parented. People form relationships in the way that they're used to. This is that conditioning. Hi there. This is that conditioning that goes on. So this is what we have to overcome. That's really the biggest challenge in your life. So, you know, because you can, when you're fulfilling duty all the time, you can feel like, when's it going to end? You can get resentful to it. And you can lose the love that you actually have for people you care for, because you always feel like you're just, you know, doing your duty. So it becomes joyless. You know, you end up feeling guilty every time you do something differently that they may not want. Or if you feel like you've let them down in some way, you know, there's some sort of guilt and shame because you haven't been able to live up to their expectations. So you learn to, you end up not being able to appreciate the smallest things that are really worth appreciating. You know, little things like, I do like that, it sounds a bit poetic and romantic, but, you know, think of all the times you can walk around, even in the city, you can find roads, busy roads, where there are little flowers or weeds growing in cracks, where 1,000 cars a day drive over. It's a miracle. There's these little things. So, because in order to take up the trying to meet these challenges or to have that energy to try and calm the mind and open the heart, it takes a lot of work, you know. So you can't lose sight of kindness and compassion. For yourself as well. That's why in the teaching of metta, the Buddha said the first person in the metta practice, the first person you start with is yourself. May I be well, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. Because you can't pour water from an empty cup. I can't pour water into your cup if my cup is empty. I've got nothing to give. You know? And so if your cup ends up empty because you're always giving and giving and, you know, driven by that sense of, I have to do this, I have to, you don't understand, I have to do this, you know, because what will happen if I don't? Well, you don't know that. You're allowed to say no at times. You're allowed to be yourself. It doesn't mean you don't care or respect someone just because you don't do everything that they want you to do. What if they wanted you to rob a bank? You know? What if they wanted you to kill someone else? Or hurt someone else? Or steal? Some of the cases I've come across in my work involve parents who've taught their kids to steal. Poor little 5, 6-year-olds, they take them on shopping trips. And the kids already know how to steal. So they think that's normal. What sort of parents do that? Imagine if you grew up with a parent like that. So you can say, well, I'm lucky I've got good parents that didn't teach me to do that and say that's okay. And clearly they do care about you and want you to do well and be safe in the world. But actually, you know, to some degree it's a false hope. When you look at history, we're actually in a very privileged time and place, because it's not following the normal pattern. If you look back over the 20th century, every continent, every country had enormous upheavals. People had their homes taken away, and you may have parents or grandparents that experienced all that. So this period of time that we're in, particularly in Australia, where there's been Australia, we haven't been bombed, you know, we get floods in the country, but we haven't been invaded, you know, nothing's landed on our heads, no earthquakes opened up. It's all been pretty minor. We go gaga when Newcastle gets an earthquake and ruins a couple of old buildings and a few people get hurt, you know. But when you look at, you know, what even's happened in the last 2 weeks overseas with floods and bombs in the Middle East, we're actually in a place that makes no sense, because the rest of the world isn't functioning that way. So this is not normal. This is just good fortune. This is just beneficial. Yeah, it gives us the time and a place, and it gives us the resources to be able to sit and take up the challenge of finding peace and wisdom within your own mind, rather than thinking you need to get more, you know, and get, because you may do everything that you want and everything your parents want, but you don't know what's coming 5 or 10 years down the track. No one does. It's good to learn good habits. It's good to have a moral, you know, compassionate viewpoint of the world. But not everyone does. What do you do when you meet someone who doesn't give a shit? Get out of my way, you know? Not meaning to be too sensitive, I can see that, you know, fairly Asian population. When I came to Australia as a 10-pound pom. So white and English. And I was racially abused. What sort of poof the name's Giles, mate? You know, why do you talk so funny? And I had red hair, so, you know, ranger. And you get jokes like, what ways, because back then everyone came by boats. So, you know, so they used to say, the favourite joke at the time was, what weighs 40,000 tonnes and looks beautiful? A boatload of poms going back to England. Pommy bastards, pommy whinges. You know, that's what I grew up with. And I'm white and English, so Australia are equal opportunity racists. You know. After that, in the 60s, historically, after that, the Italians had already come through, but the Greeks started coming through in the mid-late 60s, so they were all wogs. You know, bloody wog bastards. You know, and after the wogs, it was Vietnamese. And so, you know, anybody who's got an Asian appearance, you get pretty much the same sort of insults, you know. So I've got an Aboriginal daughter, niece. I have an Asian goddaughter. And, you know, so, yes, white people in Australia just like to insult others sometimes. And it'll never change. Some people do it, some people don't, you know. But then my understanding with other people from other cultures is, you know, Indians don't like Pakistanis, Pakistanis don't like Indians, they insult them. Vietnamese don't like Cambodians, Chinese don't like anybody. Americans think they rule the world. English hate the French. French hate the Germans. Do you know? And it's all based on an idea that there is something intrinsic about where you're born and where you look. When genetically, if they put our tissue under the microscope, they're not going to find any difference. So it's all mind-made. All our suffering is mind-made, based on what we want to hold on to in our own thinking. So the challenge is within your own thinking, how to free your thinking up, how to free yourself from those expectations of others, expectations of yourself, about what you think is important and how to find what is actually important. It doesn't mean you have to drop out of uni, you know, and stop doing things, but you keep that in mind at the same time. It's just one of those things, because you can do a lot of good as a lawyer or a doctor. You know, I've often had the thought in my own life, I wish I had been a little bit more energetic and, academically driven when I was younger. I ended up getting a master's and a couple of other postgraduate things later. But I wish I'd done it in my 20s, because I think now, I wouldn't mind being a doctor now, because if I was a doctor, I'd have more influence. I could do more of this and more of that. You know, unfortunately, it's taken me 50-odd years to, you know, and 20-odd years of meditation to suddenly realise, that would be really good if I could do that, because I could help more others, you know. But I wasn't interested in doing that much for others when I was in my 20s. I was much more interested in seeing how much I could drink, you know, and how much work I could get out of it and not do and still get paid, you know. So my values were not that strong, you know. So if you've got strong values, that's nothing to be ashamed of. And if you've got a strong work ethic, that's something to be thankful for, because being able to make a good effort and to work hard is necessary. Meditation is hard work. Meditation is not about just blissing out and feeling good and forgetting everything, because meditation is about challenging you to overcome, to find out the truth, to find out what's important, to let go of the things that aren't important, you know, and to learn to care about yourself as well. You're always going to disappoint others. People are always going to get disappointed in you. But the people who care about you and love you unconditionally are always going to be there to say, it's okay, I still care, you're still important to me. You know? They're not going to abandon you because, you know, in some way you've let them down. They're not going to make you feel guilty or ashamed just because you've done something to make yourself happy. If there were more happy people in the world would be a happier place. And in a way, they're robbing it because, you know, I really like spending time with my father now and talking to him, and it hasn't always been the case. And you know, and he's 85 now, and he's pretty good, he's pretty sharp, he's, you know, moves around. And now I worry about not being able to have that time with him, not being able to talk to him or see him, you know. My mother's already died. And so again, you know, having had a kind of troubled relationship with her for a long time, and then coming to peace and having that open affection and care, I didn't get enough of it. You know, by the time that I could have that clear relationship and you know, not feel sort of deprived in any way, you know, it ended too soon. I wish I'd come to that. And I don't see it as my mother's fault, you know. If I wanted to, I could blame her for as much. And that's what I did. When I blamed her for everything, it didn't make me happy. It made me more unhappy. And then the more I tried to change her and my dad, the less they changed. You know? Because they were just being themselves. When I learnt to forgive them, and in the end it was virtually, okay, I'll just do what they want and I'll stop trying to make them into something else. And so then it made it really easy for me to get, because I was doing it by choice. So I was still kind of still doing what they wanted, but I was doing it by choice because I had kind of embraced that. At the same time, I was stronger about what I was about and what was important to me as well. So at the same time, I was less shy about saying what I thought and what I felt. But I could do it without getting angry and having to scream it at them, you know? I could say things like, look, Mum or Dad, I know you think it's like this or this is what you want, but, you know, I'm not going to be able to do that. For me, it's like this. However, I can do all that. So finding that balance. And then it made it easier to be, I guess, in a sense, a good son. But it wasn't so much about, for me, it wasn't about being a good son. What for me it was is that I wanted to feel closer to my parents and I wanted to feel more connected, and I didn't want to feel resentful towards them. So that was my challenge, you know. And fortunately, I can't say it did take a couple of years, but mainly it was because I had to keep letting go of my resentments. I had to keep letting go of my kind of ideas in my head, you know, about what I wish they'd stop doing this, I wish they'd start doing this, and why do they have to do that? You know. And just realise that that's how they were always going to be, but they were good people. And they were coming from a good place. And, you know, what's the big deal? I still went out and, you know, but I still had the freedom to do what I thought became important to me. I was kind of lucky, though, in a sense, because my parents, I think one of the differences, my parents were never dictatorial about what I had to do or not do. They were just happy to see that I had a job and I could look after myself. So they were never, I was fortunate, you know, and that's one of the things I came to realise. I was fortunate that even though I could tell you, at one stage I could have given you, you know, 5 foolscap pages of what was wrong with them, I couldn't write anything down about what was right with them. And so when I started to focus on more about what I thought was okay about them and the fact that, you know, when you balance this up and that up, you know, they didn't lock me in a cupboard and hit me with a broom, You know, mum worked 8 hours a day. She did work 8 hours a day and come home and cook for six kids. I can't do that. If I'm tired after a day at work, just get out of my face, you know. Just want to sit on the lounge and be left alone. So I just started to be able to acknowledge that, those things within them, and realise that, you know, that was them. I could, and once I learned to accept them as the way they were, it also I could accept myself in the way that I wanted to be. Like, for instance, when I... So, different to you, you may have been raised as a Buddhist. When I started to show an interest in Buddhism and that, they thought I was joining a cult. You know? That's not what English people do. So, and so rather than getting angry and upset with them, it's just a case of coming to, like, gently trying to help them to understand it. So as I said, the main challenge, life is the challenge. This is what Buddha said. Life is suffering from start to finish. And at one level, physically, you know, I can tell you now, as I get closer, every day I get a different ache and I go, where did that come from? You know, up until I was in my 30s, I could fall over 10 times a day and forget about it, you know. It'd be gone in a couple of days. And then suddenly, I'd fall over and I'm still hurting 6 months later. You know, your body's not yours. You don't own it. No matter how many times you go to the hairdresser, no matter how many times you go shopping, what you put on it, what you eat, you know, whatever your favourite lipstick is or aftershave is, you don't own your body. If you did, would you look the way you do now? I'd be about 6'2". I'd have long hair, perfect teeth. I'd rather tan, I freckle, you know. So if I could tan, that would be much better, because then I could be brown. You know? I think I'd prefer black hair to blonde. You know. But you don't own your body. It starts to turn on you. There's a great line in a song that says, your body is a dream that turns violent. It's so true. You've all had flus by now, haven't you? You like it? No, it's terrible, isn't it? Feel awful. And it doesn't matter what you take, you can't really get rid of it, you have to wait. Sometimes, you know, so suffering. You ever had a toothache? Well, wait for that one then. Wait till you crack a tooth and it gets infected. What sort of, if there's a God, what sort of God puts teeth right next to the nervous system that goes to your brain? I tell you, that is a nasty thing to do, you know? Because when your teeth get infected and those nerves start to inflame, people, you know, in the past, people would jump off a cliff. The pain is incredible. So, and when they take that tooth out, the relief is incredible. You know, as soon as they put the anaesthetic in, the absence of suffering is bliss. It's not that you're actually in bliss, but when you stop suffering, it's like bliss, because you're not suffering. So in meditation, when you stop the mind, when you quieten the mind, and you stop thinking, it's blissful. Only because it's so peaceful. And that's why I said in the instructions at the beginning, don't watch your thoughts, because you can't control them. And the more you try to control them, the worse they'll get. Have you ever tried to tell a three-year-old to shut up? What do they do? Yo, you shut up! And then they start screaming at me. You know? It's the same with your mind. If you tell your mind to shut up, it's like, you shut up. So you just keep it very simple. Just watch the breath. Don't worry about trying to fix your thoughts. Don't worry if you're having good thoughts or bad thoughts, right thoughts or wrong thoughts. Just watch the breath and see where that takes you. Just make it that simple. You know, your thoughts will continue, and every time they come up, every time you suddenly realise, oh, I'm thinking again, or I'm watching my thoughts, or I'm trying to change my thoughts, just ask yourself, where's my breath? How does it feel? And eventually, when you keep going back there, those little neural pathways that go watch the breath get stronger, and that ability to watch the breath, and then that's when it gets really interesting. when you start to develop this fascination, this curiosity about what happens when all I do is let go of everything, let go of all the things I think I have to do, I don't have to fix anything, give yourself permission, give yourself time off. You don't have to fix anything. You don't have to improve yourself. You don't have to stop anything. You don't have to understand anything. You just have to stay and watch the breath. So you stay with the feeling. You don't stay with the thinking. You don't think about the breath. You just stay with the feeling as long as you can. And I can guarantee you, the longer that you stay with that feeling of the breath, then the breath will take you into that quietness, that stillness, that peacefulness. And in that quietness and that stillness and peacefulness, things start to make sense. Things start to get clearer, you know, over time. The more you do it, the more you go back there. When you're in that clear space and everything calms down, you can see. You know when you're in a nightclub, sorry to sound like you know, gender bias, but I'm a male, so I'll talk from a male's point of view. So when you're, and I have to draw my memory, because as I was saying to someone today, I actually can't remember the last time I was in a nightclub. But when you're in a nightclub and you meet a girl that you try to talk to and find out more about, you have to really yell, because the music is coming over and everyone else is talking, and then they still say, "What did you say?" And so that's what trying to sit and meditate can be like sometimes. You try to find this quietness and all you find is noise. And that's why I say, don't worry about all of that. Just develop that capacity to do, just keep it as simple as that. What does my breath feel like? Where is it? And stay with that. Just stay with that sensation of the breath, because the breath is, in a nice way, also like a little child. But it's very shy. So if you don't allow yourself to get down to its level and just be quiet, and just let it speak to you, you'll lose it. Yeah? So, but once you stay with it, and you stay with it for a long period of time, it will draw you in to that quietness and peacefulness. And you'll know, you don't have to guess. You don't have to think, was that meditating or not? And then your neighbour says, "No, you were snoring for an hour." But it's not about that. It's what happens is, as you start to quiet down, and as you start to let go of your thoughts, or you kind of drift away from the thinking, you naturally start to feel peaceful. It feels good. And that's how you'll know if you're on the right track. You will actually feel pleasant. It feels pleasant. You know why it feels pleasant? It's because it's the absence of suffering. Thinking is suffering. It's like a toothache if you haven't had one yet. Well, it's like a mozzie bite, you know? And you finally put some cream on it and the itch goes away. It's kind of nice, you know? Or if it's a hot day and you walk into an air-conditioned room, it's this cooling down. And so when you cool down, when you cool the thinking down, it naturally feels very pleasant. And then all you do is just sit with that. You don't have to do more. You don't have to pull more in. You just learn to sit patiently with it. One of the things you have to do in meditation is let go of waiting for something good to happen and just sit with what is. But that physical sensation of the breath. Always make it about just allowing yourself to feel the breath. And the more that you do that and everything else goes into the background, then you just naturally just start to feel, oh, that kind of feels peaceful. Something goes missing. And what goes missing is a sense of restlessness. You know, you'll get challenged. It's a bit like, because the mind is both your friend and your enemy. So sometimes when it finds out you're trying to develop peacefulness and calmness, it'll start yelling at you. "You can't meditate. You're not any good at it. You haven't got time to meditate. You should be studying, you know. You're supposed to be doing this right now. What are you doing just sitting there watching your breath? That's stupid. That won't get you a job." All this kind of challenges will come up inside it. Don't worry about it. Don't try to fix them or make them go away. Just know that that's what it's going to try and do. It's not about thinking. It's about just staying with the feeling. So you're changing things around. Because the mind is often like an untrained dog. If you've ever had a big dog that hasn't been trained and you have it on a lead, it pulls you wherever it wants to go. And that's what our minds usually work like. But when you see a really well-trained dog, They're not even on a lead, they walk with you. So the mind, in order to make the mind your genuine friend, you have to tame it. And you can tame it through mindfulness and meditation. So the way to do that is stop trying to fix your thinking, stop trying to change the way you think, try to be a better person or do all the right things, and just give yourself permission to just stay with the breath. The breath is called a tranquility meditation. The reason why it's called a tranquility meditation, it's called samatha, is tranquility, is because when you concentrate, you become tranquil. You become more peaceful. And in that peacefulness and that quietness and that stillness, things get clearer. Or you just have the energy, you know. But it's a long, slow process. You didn't get to where you are today overnight. You didn't get to be the person you are right now, yesterday. It's not like you woke up this morning and, you know, you were someone else yesterday and you're someone else today. It's taking you, you know, 15, 18, 20, 30 years, 50 years, 60 years to get to where you are. So, you know, be kind to yourself. Even if you have a fantastic meditation, that doesn't mean everything's going to be fixed. You just do it. The more you do it, the more those neural pathways, the more the brain gets to like it and keeps going back there, you know, quicker and quicker. And you're not going to suddenly... I've met very few people that have done meditation and had fantastic meditation and then suddenly given up their job and left their families and become a monk and done that, you know? The Buddha did, but even he was 30 before he did it, and at least he had a family first. But it doesn't do anything. It does genuinely help you cope with the challenges of life because it makes you mentally stronger. So on one level, learning to meditate and practicing meditation every day is like doing push-ups. You know, push-ups will make you physically stronger. Doing 20 or 30 minutes meditation a day, or maybe 10 minutes twice a day, will make you mentally stronger. It'll give you that capacity to cope with stress and, you know, cope with parents and lecturers and social pressures and stuff like that. But it'll also give you the clarity to start to see things a little bit differently. It starts to shake the foundations. It starts to loosen the idea of who you think you are. It gives you room to move. And sometimes it even gives you happiness. And that changes a lot of things. So thank you for listening. I'm happy to take a few questions because I ended up not asking questions after you. You know, Ajahn Brahm always says this little thing about the reason why people are born stupid. I don't know if it's entirely politically correct, so I'm trying to say Ajahn Brahm's joke, not mine. But I'm telling it. But he'd say this because they didn't ask enough questions in the previous life. Yeah?
On what you said about you know, not feeling you need to meet others' needs or what they think are their needs.
Yeah.
So I completely agree, but I get quite caught up in doing that.
Yeah.
It's my little specialty. And and I agree.
That's who you are.
But I agree with everything you said about it, but it's so hard to change as a habit, even though I can see that I would like to change that.
Yeah.
But it's so hard to change because it feels like compassion, and it does come from
compassion.
A place of compassion.
Yeah. So, well, look, that is the case, but where's your compassion for yourself? So, you know, it's like even in tithing, you know, and in donations and stuff, you can't give more than you've got. And so I agree, so for you it's maybe finding that balance. And I do the same. So, you know, I do a little bit of charity work and I, you know, give time and money to other charities, and I still get a little twang of kind of guilt when I walk past people on the street begging for money, you know, because I feel like I should give them. You're a Buddhist, you're generous and kind, give them money. No, they're there all the time, they don't work. You know, so when I started to do that, I'd go, oh, well, they're pretty well, but they're obviously not skinny. Sometimes I do give money to people on the street. If they look really dirty and skinny and a bit unwell mentally, I will, you know. But for instance, last year I saw this guy at Maroubra. And then I saw him in the city, and then I saw him somewhere else, and I thought, you know. So you come back to it and you look at the people you're giving to and what you're giving, but partly compassion is also compassion for yourself. So what are your needs? What do you need? You know, I can't give 24/7. So I think come back to the position of what do I need in order to feel, you know, at ease and comfortable and kind. And if you feel like you're doing things because you're driven to, that's when I would say give yourself permission to say no, I can't do it. And if you get a response from people you're trying, well, I thought you said you were, you know, then clearly they're the wrong person to be giving to. Because, you know, I saw this beautiful clip on YouTube the other day, and YouTube is both a, you know, it's a sinner and a saint. I really like this. It was two Indian guys pulled a rickshaw in India. It was 45 degrees. The guy pulling the rickshaw looked to me about 70. You know, he was probably only 50 because he's lived outside. And he was a skinny little thing. And he took them 2 kilometres. And when they got out, these guys were obviously a little bit more affluent. And they said, oh, what do you make on an average day? And he said, oh, about 20, 25 rupees. I don't know, what's that, about 50 cents a day or something like that? And they said, what do you make in a month? And he said, oh, maybe 200 or 300 rupees. And so they gave him 3,000 rupees, and it took them some time because he wouldn't accept it. You know, and he said, No. And they go, no, we want you to have it because you've got a family, you need to look after your family. So if people are genuinely, you know, I've always found it, because you know, people are genuinely needy, they are compassionate and understanding about it in return. They don't ask for more. I can remember once giving a guy on the street 50 cents and he looked and he says, is that all? I said, give it back then. You know, like, so, literally that happened to him, you know. And I had a guy the other day, I'm getting money out of the bank at, because I work at Liverpool. So I'm in the mall at Liverpool, I just happen to be drawing out some cash for the day. This guy's walking past, he says, oh, can I have 50? And I was dumbfounded, right? Because he just happened to be walking past, and he sees me. And I've decided over the years, maybe I've just got a kind of a kind face and people think it's an easy mark. So I've learned to say no quite a lot. You know, again, King Street the other day, and the guy's just walking past, and he just stops and says, oh, can I have a dollar? And I'm thinking, well, what is it about me? People are always asking me for money, you know? Have I got a sign on me or something? But this guy in the mall goes, can I have 50? And I thought, he doesn't mean 50 cents. He means 50 bucks. And then he goes, oh, okay, what about 20 then? Exactly, that was my response. And I said, I looked at him and I said, no. And walked away. Do you know? Not everyone who asks for your help needs it. And sometimes if we keep giving help, we stop. I do subscribe to the idea, if you keep giving help, they don't learn independence. So when you give help, and a lot of big charities now try to do this, they look at how can we empower that community to be able to look after themselves so that we don't keep giving them handouts. It's in no one's interest to have to live with handouts. You know. And some people are happy to do that, you know. But it's not good for yourself, your self-development. It degrades you as a human being over time, and that's where people who are genuine do feel ashamed of having to ask for help. So, you know, in your case, if that's a pattern of your behaviour, if you can feel yourself driven to do it, that's when I think you should say no. If you feel there's a joy in what you're doing, do it. Do you know? But if you feel like it's like a compulsion, I can't not, that's when you should say no.
In terms of what you were saying about trying to stop old reactions to thoughts and trying to change that and make a conscious decision to change, what if, for instance, you know the steps that you need to make and the good part of yourself is telling you, yes, that's the right thing to do, and then you're nearly there and then, like...
Sabotage!
In one second, the other part of you says... just stick to the old ways, it's way more fun.
Exactly.
How do you kind of ensure that you just keep committed to yourself and the good part of yourself to continue?
So you have to accept that you are always going to get that kind of temptation arise. Okay. Like the first time I did a weekend retreat, it was like you know, and it started on a Friday night, and I just remember going, what am I doing with these weirdos that wear sandals when I could be at the park? You know, this is like, and the food's terrible, it's just weird, what is it, what am I doing here? And I thought I was kind of lucky because I realised, well, I don't know, you know, and yeah, I would rather be at the pub, but I do that every week, you know, so maybe I can spend a few nights trying something new, you know, I'll still be able to go back there, you know, and I've certainly been back since, and so it's not forever. It's about giving yourself the opportunity, so just accept that there's part of you that does want that. Of course you does, you know. That is the nature of having five senses. That is the nature of kilesas. They want entertaining, you know, and to some degree it is boring. Sitting and watching your breath, it's not always heavenly bliss. My experience is, you know, it's probably 80% kind of neutral, and it's about 15% unpleasant and difficult, and probably 1%, 2% pleasant. But over time, what I can say actually now, is it, you know, difficult because it reduces. I think what I have is the benefit now of maybe having tried for 20 years and having come from a fairly hedonistic and self-preoccupied way of living and still being a fair bit like that, but because change takes a while, you know, and so for me what happened was I just accepted at some point after the first couple of years of my practice, I accepted that this was a practice I needed to keep doing and keep practicing, and it was going to take a while. So the shift takes place over time. You're not going to get the miracle of suddenly becoming a saintly person who's no longer interested in all those hedonistic Western Kim Kardashian type things, you know. It's like that even Kim Kardashian can become a great teacher, as you know, in terms of what does, you know, what, you know, what price fame when you allow yourself to be filmed doing sexual acts in order to become famous, or to take your clothes off all the time because she's got no other talent. It's not like she's written a book, done a movie, even seen. You know, she's just famous for being willing to do anything. Is the money worth it? Do you know? I mean, she's done wonders for big bottom girls. She's made that very popular, you know. But what, you know, does she give to charity? Anyone heard about the charities that were there? Anyone ever seen her visit a hospital or a kid's hospital? You heard her talk? Oh, I don't know, I don't really feel, you know, just meditate. I just meditate and, you know, I use my moisturizer a lot and it just makes my life so much better, you know. And I am being flippant about it because that's how she presents. But there is no substance to her. It's all about being famous and being seen and having money. That's her goal. And she's achieved it. But at what cost? Personally, I'd say personal dignity. But she's at a point where that doesn't even offend her. You know, when I grew up, if a celebrity had been filmed, even take a photo taken topless, the shame involved, they would have almost disappeared. To actually have, you know, in terms of what her history is and how it made her famous, defies just logic. Because normally it would be shameful. Would you be happy about that? If your sister or someone you know got photographed pleasuring their partner in that way and they stuck it all over, you know, you can go and find it and take you. It's like, what? What's that about? You know? At least with other people who are famous, they try to do things and spread that wealth. She doesn't. She keeps it all for herself. So why is... And it says a lot about what's wrong with the world that she is so famous and she gets so much money for being selfish, preoccupied, vain, narcissistic, and stupid. I mean, some people might say she can't be that stupid to be that rich. But it just shows you how worthless money is, because look at who they give it to. So if you think money is your answer, it's not. It gives you more choices. It doesn't make you a better person. Being famous doesn't make you a better person. If you want to be talked about, what do you want to be talked about for? what an arsehole you are, how vain you are, and there's a, you know. Because the only answer she's got is, well, I've got money. But she's also married to that lunatic. Well, you want to wake up to him every day? Can I just tell you how good I am today? Jesus! You know? I don't think it's worth it. So you've got to have a good sense of what's important to you and why is it important to you. And so, yeah, good things are a struggle. Good things do take a sacrifice. But in the end, the payoff in the Buddhism and those sacrifices should be not resentment about people not appreciating everything you've done for them, and anger because no one ever acknowledges you or appreciates you and you quietly suffer. It should be a sense of being peaceful and content within. It should be a better sense of understanding. Although, again, I find the world makes no sense. I can understand things. I work in a field, you know, I work in mental health. It's all about trying to understand things and people. And we do a lot better, you know, but it makes no sense. Why is it some people do these things and others don't? Why is it some people can be so cruel? You know, why is it other people are so kind? I'm just grateful that, for me, I'm grateful that I've made a decision to try and be kinder and calmer and wiser. And I've got a lot of work to do. And I'm grateful that I've got time to do it. I'm grateful that there are people, I appreciate the fact there are people around me that, you know, even if they're not Buddhist, most of my friends are not Buddhist, and my family aren't, but there are people that care about me, they're kind, you know. So I try to see what's good, even though I know there's a lot of bad in the world. I can't change that. I can change me. And when you change yourself, you change the world. When you make yourself, when you do suddenly... It's not about changing, it's really about letting go, because meditation is all about letting go. The more you let go of thinking about all the things and putting all the demands, the easier it is to be calm and peaceful. At some point when you let go of worrying about the fact that you're not having an exciting enough life, you'll be having a really exciting life. You know, it kind of happens naturally, it doesn't happen because, you know, so don't be in a hurry about it, just accept the fact that, you know, you've got more than one interest. That's not a bad thing. And in fact, in some ways, sometimes it's okay, you know, I'm not a monk, so I can be a little bit more... Like, sometimes it's okay to take the pressure off for a weekend. If you take every weekend off, that's a problem. If you take every night off, that's a problem. Because I can guarantee you, too, over time, I you know, at one stage in my life, the idea of not going out between Thursday and Sunday... was like, do you want to shoot me now? You know, is that it? You may not think that in the 80s and 90s we did much, but we did, you know. We thought we did. So, but the idea that I would be staying home and not doing anything for those four nights of the week was like, oh, I've just died, you know. And literally going out at 10, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, didn't even start till then. Most nights I'm in bed. It's pretty rare I'm not in bed by anything. And if you told me I had to go out at midnight, I'd be like, shoot me, just shoot me. It changes naturally. The reason why it changes naturally is because you get older and your body just can't do it. I can't believe how much I used to be able to drink and get up and go to work. I'd be out till 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, jump in bed for an hour, be up at 6, 6.30, go to work. The poor people I used to look after, because I would have reeked of alcohol and cigarettes. And I was like, by 10 o'clock I just wanted to die because I was so tired and my head hurt so much. So you take a couple of Panadine and just a couple of strong coffees and somehow get through the end of the day, you know. That was real suffering. I don't know, that was the most suffering. I don't know how I did that. I'm glad I pulled out probably in my late 20s. I still went out, you know, when I look at it, sort of was up here in my early mid-20s and it came down very quickly and then it kind of just like that. And, you know, once you get past 45, unless you're an idiot, you really start to naturally appreciate peace and quiet and calmness. So if you already do, you're really lucky. You're not boring. You're very fortunate, because I wish I hadn't wasted so much money and time talking to people I don't remember, doing things I don't remember, you know. And then having to pay the price physically later. I can, some of my, you know, ailments that I've got it's kind of helped me to accept the fact that some of the health problems I've had in the last couple of years are self-made, you know, because you just can't do that to yourself and expect not to have consequences. So, you know, that's just a natural, that's a bit of karma really, but it's also physics, you know, if you put enough poison in your system, it's got to come out at some point, it's going to do something to you. So don't be ashamed if you enjoy peace and quiet and calmness. You're really lucky. I wish I'd been more like that in my 20s than I am now. Because I think I would have done more. But I'm grateful now. I'm really fortunate. I do have a job, you know, despite the fact I've never had any ambition, I'm very well paid, you know, I have a lot of responsibility and I do things that are very beneficial to the community. So I just figure I must have been bored, because one of my first questions to a monk when I met a monk was in terms of understanding karma, because I realised when I grew up, I said, I've had friends that are really good people, they do one thing wrong and they, you know, virtually end up in jail. You know, that's it, they've stuffed up their whole life. I said, I've done lots of wrong things, you know, I've broken the law loads of times and done things that are, you know, criminal. And I've never been caught. And I'm not saying that in any boastful way. I was like, and his answer was, and I've had similar answers from other monks. He said, well, this was Ajahn Brahm's answer to me. He said, it's like you've got a glass of water, right? And you put a few teaspoons of salt in it. You know, if you try to drink that glass, it's too salty. But if you throw a couple of teaspoons of salt into a swimming pool, you won't even notice it. So he said, the water is like good karma. If you've got a lot of good karma, you know, even if you're stupid, you know, prodigal son sort of thing, and you waste that, or you're not very respectful of it, it doesn't really amount to anything. But if you don't have a lot of good karma, and you do something wrong, you're going to pay. It becomes noticeable. We all must have a lot of good karma in the room. You know, we've all got our fingers and toes and hands, you know. You're all at university. You've all got food and shelter. You've all got a bit of wealth, you know. You may not think you've got enough wealth or, you know, that, but you don't have to be Bill Gates, you know. If you can go out of here and you've got money for your bus and something to eat and pay your rent, you're pretty wealthy, really, you know. You've got a lot of choices and stuff in your life. So it is a bit, sometimes when we get used to thinking about what we haven't got and what we should have, that makes you unhappy. But, you know, and I guess that's where I was lucky. I never thought like that. I never thought I should have more. You know, I was never driven by the idea that I needed this or I needed that. I was always quite happy if I had enough money to go to the pub. That's all. Or, you know, if I wanted to go overseas, I've got enough money to go overseas. And sometimes literally, thank God I've got enough money to pay the rent this week. It never really worried me that I didn't have, you know, for a long period of my life, money in the bank and you know, and even though I didn't like my job, I just liked hanging out with my friends and having fun, you know, even though that fun was basically killing me. I didn't see it that way at that time. So your ideas change. But the beauty of that for me was that when I decided that life was quite harmful, and literally having friends die and overdose and literally starting to feel more and more lost and more unhappy, and realising that it wasn't working. For a couple of years it worked perfectly. The last couple of years it didn't work at all. The more I did it, the unhappier and the worse I felt, and the more things went wrong. So the good thing about, you know, not having any ambition in life and wanting to do anything was that I thought, well, I'll go to a monastery. Might as well see what happens if I sit there, you know. Turned out to be a really good thing to do. So, if I'd followed the traditional life, like very early in my life, at one point where I hadn't worked for a couple of years and I decided I needed to work, one of the first jobs I got offered was with an insurance company. And it was great. They were, you know, just as a retainer, they were going to give me twice what I was going to earn in my normal job, just a retainer, and then I get commission on top of that. And it was a big company too. And so just, I had 3 interviews. I went through all the things. So it was quite amazing. I wore my best nightclub clothes to the interview. You made a comment about that. I was like, I clearly wasn't wearing the normal kind of everyday suit outfit. But anyway, I got the job. And then right at the last moment, when he offered me the job, he said, do you belong to any clubs? Do you play any sport? I said, yeah, I used to like playing cricket and football, so I was in a couple of teams. He said, and for some reason it was like made a sound in my head. And as I was walking from the office down to the car park, I kept coming back to that. Why did he ask me that? What was that question about? Why wasn't it in the interview? Why was he asking me if I played tennis? I couldn't let it go. By the time I got to the car, what I realised was that I'll never have a real friend again. If I take the job, I'll never have a real friend again because I want them to buy insurance. Everyone I meet, I'm going to try and sell insurance to. How will I ever have a friend if everyone's going to be a potential client or customer? And I suddenly thought, I don't want to live like that. I can't live like that. And I reckon I would have been really good. I had friends and family, around me. I could have drummed up, I reckon, $50,000 worth of business in the first month in commission. And I kind of had that thought experience. I thought, I could be really successful. And unfortunately, because I was also honest about the person I was at the time, I thought, I'll probably have a cocaine addiction by the end of the year and go psychotic, So instead I took a job in the desert in an Aboriginal community at Maralinga, which is where they tested the nuclear bombs back in the 80s. So, and I was just this pasty, skinny, white kid, out in the desert by myself looking after anywhere between 15 to 300 people, depending on who turned up. And so that was a lot. I learned a lot about life there, working with the Aboriginal community. I really liked the way that they didn't try to own anything. There's a lot of problems. There's a lot of alcoholism and violence and stuff. And, I used to look after kids with, literally maggots coming out of their ears and nose and stuff like that. And but what I really liked was they weren't possessive. When I left after about 4 months. And when I left, what I really liked was that I just thought, I don't want to make them more Western. That's not the answer, to make them more like us. I don't want to live like them. But, there was this freedom too. One of the funny things they used to do, so where I was based was 300 kilometres from the main camp on a dirt road. It was only a dirt road, it was a track through the desert. Nothing in between. One of the freaky things about when you're in the desert, every night I used to sit on the sand dune and look at the horizon. And this is what delusion stuff is like. Because I'd sit there and I'd look and I'd think, I bet there's a shopping centre over that sand dune. I reckon there's a whole bloody suburb of something going on over there. There has to be. This idea that there could be thousands of miles of space and emptiness was really alien to me. I just couldn't imagine it. It's like, it's a random... Nothing there. That was probably the next one. I couldn't let go of the idea that there would have to be people and stuff hidden just around the corner. But no, there was nothing there. I'd sleep out under the stars at night, and one of the beautiful things I saw was one night there I couldn't fall asleep because for about half an hour there was a meteor shower. And not just 5 or 6, this was hundreds over half an hour just flashing across the sky. I was just like, oh. It really put me back in touch. So that was a real pivotal moment in my life where I went this path, not that path. And I had to make a choice about that. And make a lot of mistakes. And then just not giving up. Never give up on yourself. Just like I said, I know I started off saying how there's all these catastrophes just waiting to happen that you don't know about. So, life is uncertainty. But conversely, you don't know how good things are waiting for you as well. So in terms of the way of the world, the traditional projection of the world, I can say in my life, I haven't followed it at all. But for some reason, I find myself becoming happier and more content than despite my best efforts, you know, by material values, more successful. I have no idea how I did that, because it wasn't planned. If you'd asked me at 25, I'd say, well, I'll probably be homeless. And not in a good way. So, despite my best efforts, you know, things work out. And I think the thing that's allowed that is just by being, letting myself be open to things and being accepting and being a bit kind to yourself. You know, not always driving yourself to do what you think you have to do. Give yourself time off occasionally. The world doesn't stop. If people really love you, they don't stop loving you. They might be disappointed, but they don't stop loving you. They don't stop caring, if they're genuine. And if they do, you're better off without them, really. Even if it's your parents or siblings. People who care about you never stop caring about you, whatever, what you, no matter what you do. In the middle of when I was really kind of angry with my folks, I had a big motorbike accident, my hips got broken in two places and I had a pin through my leg and stuff. And when they let me out of hospital, I still couldn't do much for myself, you know, because so I had to go and stay with Mum and Dad. And Mum cooked my favourite meal for me every day that I was back at home without asking. They just let me lay on the couch, watch shitty daytime television, or, you know, didn't make me do a thing. Didn't say anything about, you know, this, that or the other. Just made sure I was safe and fed and comfortable and out of pain. So, you know, just keep that in mind. Is that okay? Are there any questions? Any more? All good? It's Friday night. So thanks for sacrificing part of it for me and the opportunity to come and ramble on at you for a while and being so generous and kind in listening.